Colonel Hubert Julian, who's here with me today, just gave his own introduction. He called himself tall, tan, terrific. Finish the rest of it, Colonel.
Well, I said tall, tan, terrific, eager to go. Wherever there's war, rumors of wars, intrigues, intrigues.
Who called you the Black Eagle? Where'd that come from?
Well, I tell you, it originated in view of the fact that I was the first and only black flyer in the world. During the various press interviews, they said, well, you better accept this. H. Allen Smith, a low man on the totem pole, years ago in a press conference on the Aquitana coming from Europe.
When you attempted that first flight, that really spectacular one in 24, to fly from New York to Africa, which was, what, about 5 or 6 years before Lindbergh even flew the Atlantic?
Yes, July the 4th, 1924, exactly.
Did you really expect to make it?
Yes, because it wasn't a nonstop flight. And as it's explained in the book, The Black Eagle, it gives all the details.
Your first stop was unscheduled, however.
Well, yes, but you see, my first stop really was to be Atlantic City to change a pontoon that was damaged. You see, I couldn't put the flight off when there were 200,000 some believers and other non-believers on the banks of the river on the 4th of July who had put off the holiday to see the start. So we had planned to stop in Atlantic City, change a pontoon, and go all the way down to Florida, from Florida to Cuba, Cuba to San Domingo, and touch in St. Martin and all the island in the West Indies to Demerara and all the way to Cape San Roque, over to the island of Santa Maria, and then from Santa Maria over to Africa. You see, it was in stages.
Well, the first flight certainly made you very famous, didn't it?
Well, infamous, I should say. Yeah. Of course, it was well planned, and I had hoped to fly to Ethiopia, which was the only African empire at the time.
The reason the Colonel is here today is because there's a new book, which I assume is an authorized biography, being that you're here plugging it, by John Pierre Nugent, and it's called, correctly enough, The Black Eagle.
That is correct, sir.
You pleased with the book?
Very pleased indeed, because The Black Eagle, as detailed by John Nugent, give all the facts of impossible deeds. Of course, take the mission impossible that you'll find in The Black Eagle, and that was on the 30th of April, 1923. I made a parachute jump in the heart of New York City, and I wouldn't do it for $10 million tax-free today. In those days, you had the two elevated railroads and the East River, and the Hudson River is 3.5 miles apart. And a fool is going to come down in a parachute with all the overhead wires and land within one block of pre-arranged destination. But the part that was mission impossible is when I was arrested, and the judge prohibited me from flying over New York City for 6 months. And I called the 23rd Street precinct. I said, at 4 o'clock, prepare another summons. I'm going to land right on the precinct. And I exactly did that. And that was mission impossible.
I wanted to ask you, Colonel, about a story that you told me, and I don't remember the details of it. When I went to visit you about 6 years ago in your home over in the Bronx, and it had to do with Mussolini, and you had a gun up your sleeve, and when you were to reach forward to shake his hand, the gun was to go off. Now, can you tell me the story?
Well, what actually happened was that I pretended that I was in favor of the Ethiopian invasion in order to gain admission to Italy. But the object of that was to assassinate Mussolini. Now, I couldn't just whip out a gun. So what I did, I had the gun, the strap to the side of my arm with my coat over it. And around my body, there was a cord attached to the trigger. So when I raised my hand to salute him, of course, it'll pull the trigger and the automatic will go off. But I knew that I'll be dead.
Now, what happened?
Well, what happened was that in the anteroom, Count Ciano said, my gosh, I'm disappointed. Such a tall, handsome, Herculean man like you. I'm glad I'm not a woman. And you mean to tell me that you went to Ethiopia to sacrifice your life for a monkey, a Selassie? And, the thought of that, of course, my blood run cold. And he said, well, I'm sorry, you're in no position to see El Duce today. Wait until you're more composed. And that's why I didn't go into the next room.
Did you ever meet him?
Never met him, no.
Tell me a little bit about Father Divine, because you knew him pretty well.
Well, I call him a mystery man. He was a man of a lot of powers, and as I relate in the book The Black Eagle, that he first employed me to fly him all over the United States so his angels could see him, and of course I was well paid, $100 a day whether I flew or not, and he chartered a plane for $50,000, and the thing that mystified me about Father Divine was that if there were 5,000 people in a room and he pointed to that door and said everybody through that door, there was no hesitancy. He had full control. And the thing that I liked about him was that he practiced and saw to it that his followers practice honesty. If they had run away from paying debts in order to be a member of his cult, you'd have to pay back all your debts. And the police was very pleased to know that it was a man who could control people as he did.
What was Father Divine like on a personal basis? You must have chatted with him flying around.
Gosh. Well, he was about 5 feet 2 inches. He was very personable and knowledgeable, and his oratory was superb, convincing, dynamic.
You're from Trinidad.
Yes, from Port of Spain, Trinidad.
Your folks were fairly well off, weren't they?
Well, they
relatively speaking.
Well, compared to the poor elements, they were well enough off to send me to school in England.
Were you conscious in Trinidad of racial prejudice?
No, because in Trinidad, it isn't what you look like, it's who you were and what you had.
Well, when was the first time you were conscious of it, sir?
Right in the, on the 21st, on the 8th day of March, 1921, right, my first visit to Washington, D.C. You see, I don't know whether the Black Eagle, the book Black Eagle, has a diagram of it, but I invented the parachute that's being used by the spacecraft agency. And I went to Washington to patent it on the 8th of March, 1921. And when I arrived at the patent office, one of the clerks said, why, nigger, you're in the wrong place. This is not for songwriters. This is for inventors. And then it struck me.
He really called you nigger?
Oh, yes. And I said to him, I beg your pardon, sir. I'm Lieutenant Julian from Canada. I'm an inventor, not a songwriter. And if you were in England or Canada, I'll have you tanned. And just then, Mr. Robert Fulton, the Commissioner of Patent, came and said, what's wrong? And I explained to him. He said, oh, yes, we had advance notice from the Canadian government that you were coming down. And I showed him. He said, oh, dear, this is so out of the ordinary. Call his examiners. And it's the first time in the history of the patent office that a patent went through the patent office in 2 months and 16 days.
You've done such extraordinary things that, you know, the fact that you're black is sort of irrelevant, because you'd be very famous if you were white, having done the things you've done.
Well, as a matter of fact, I never base my achievements on color. I base it on being a human being. Because, you see, my mother was English, and I never had the slightest thought of the differentiation of color until I came to the United States, until I realized why Papa didn't want me to come to America.
I wish you'd tell about the your challenge to Marshall Gehring.
Yes, it was at the Waldorf on 34th Street and 5th Avenue at the time. G.M. Belanca, the great aeroplane builder who built the Columbia that crossed the Atlantic with Levine, and we were dining, and he said, Hubert, did you see Mein Kampf? I said, Mein Kampf? I said, no, I wouldn't read that. He says, well, Hitler said that your people are baboons and apes and should be put in a cave. I said, he did he? So I read the book, and then I sent a challenge to Marshal Gehring. I said, I know that Hitler is not a flyer. I remember you in World War One. Therefore, if you're man enough to represent the Germans, I'll be man enough to represent the black race.
That was about 1940, right before we got into the war.
That's right. And I sent the challenge. It appeared on the front page of all the papers all over the world. And I went to England, and the British said, well, it's all right. We need flyers, and we'd like to have you in the Royal Air Force. I said, oh, no, I came here for that purpose.
Were you ever in a situation that you didn't think you could get out of, that you thought really this was going to be it?
Oh, yes. For example, I think it's on the fifth chapter in The Black Eagle, and that was when I was arrested by the UN for helping Shambi. And I knew that the Congolese wanted... You see, Shambi used to boast, "I don't give a damn about the UN. I have the Black Eagle, the most famous fighter in the world, with me." And they tricked me. I simply stopped in Belgium and bought two gold pistols. It was delivered through customs, and they used that as a subterfuge. And it was rumored that I was going to be shot by the Congolese. I said, "Well, this is it. So what?"
How did the Finns react to you when you went over there to help them at night?
Oh, well, of course, Baron Mannerheim sent for me. He knew I've met him in Europe, and...
This was when the Russians attacked Finland.
Yes, and he cabled back. He said, "It'll be a pleasure." And that is in page 18 in the Black Eagle, where it's the first time they ever saw a black flyer.
I was going to ask.
Oh, yes, guy. My gosh. And they used to come and touch me, and I think it was very nice in Finland. There were 25 women to every one man in Finland. And Baron Mannerheim's daughter said, "Hands off, the Black Eagle is mine."
Have you met Lindbergh, Colonel Lindbergh?
I knew him, yes, in 1927 out at Roosevelt Field. Of course, people ignored him. I saw him at the field. There were three planes. There was the Columbia, the America, and this little kite, we called it.
Did you think he'd make it?
Oh, yes, I had confidence. He had confidence in himself, and I had confidence in him.
Yeah. Is there anything you've always wanted to do and never gotten a chance to?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing at all.
What about in the future? Is there a challenge for you?
Yes, there's a challenge for me. The challenge to be one of the richest men in the world, which I was, which I'm not now anymore.
Of all the people you've met, now you've met an awful lot of them, famous people, interesting people, who would you say impressed you the most?
Well, believe it or not, the man who impressed me more than anyone else I ever met was the... Ali Khan.
The late Ali Khan. He was killed in the auto crash.
Auto crash, yes.
What about him impressed you?
Well, what impressed me about him was here was a man that was a multimillionaire, and yet he wasn't selfish. He was daring. He was a flyer. He was a playboy. He was a lover. He was a man after my heart.
I do. Yeah.
And yet he took time out to see to the needs of his people, he and his father. I met them both. As a matter of fact, it was on the Queen Elizabeth. And I was invited to come to Deauville, and I lived at the Hotel de Golf. And when the Aga Khan will come down the elevator and put his arms on your shoulder for you to escort him through, and when he would entrust his wife for you to take her dancing and gambling, he was a real man.
You didn't get on very well with the Bron Condor.
Well, no, I didn't get it because I sent for him. And he was a bit jealous of the things that I was doing, and he got out of line, and it was just one of those things. Of course, there was always a hatred, and still between foreign-born Negroes and the American Negro.
He was from Chicago. John
Chicago.
Robinson,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
And he's dead.
He died, unfortunately, poor fellow.
Yeah. What about Haile Selassie? Now, what sort of a man is he?
Oh, well, now you're talking about a man. Now you're talking about the Solomon of the modern age, a man whose wisdom supersedes all the present leaders, the self-called leaders, a man who predicted World War II, what would happen. I remember him saying that if you permit my country to be raped, someday it will happen to you, and it did happen. Although he was laughed at, he was scoffed at. Of course, he didn't follow my advice, and I told him, I said, "Your Majesty, I wouldn't fight the Italians. I'll pay the small indemnity." He said, "Well, what about the League of Nations?" I said, "What about it?" I said, "Look at the map of Africa. Every country in Africa is owned by a European power but Ethiopia. And do you think that they will send troops to fight one of their bandits that occupy Africa so that you could maintain your sovereignty?"
Well, now, just recently, the Vice President, Spiro Agnew, had great praise for the black African leaders and compared them unfavorably with the black leaders here.
Well, as a matter of fact, he had great praise for the black African leaders. He should have great praise for a African leader. There's only one. And that's Selassie. He's the only legitimate African leader.
Well, it's...
Mobutu, for example, I told the State Department, wasn't to recognize his coup. He was not elected to the Congo. He seized it from the president and had him imprisoned. And the day that we recognize him, there were five revolts. Every African country fell to military coup.
But now, if you were just an ordinary black man, where would you want to live and bring up your family? Which country?
England or Italy.
Italy?
Yes. The country I love most, and you'll see in my book, The Black Eagle, why I mention Italy. Italy is a land of culture. The Italians are not fighters. They are artists. They're painters. They're bon vivant. That's why they never won any wars. They were never meant to be soldiers.
Do you feel that they have less prejudice, the Italians?
Yes, yes, very much so indeed. They don't mind their own business.
You were a first nighter and a great celebrity during the Roaring Twenties in Harlem. What was that scene like?
Oh, well, of course, the shows that was put on by the late Irvin C. Miller and his brother Putnam Take, they were fantastic colored shows and dances, and I was a playboy in those days. I came to America very wealthy with $75,000 in a McFarlane, which was twice the length of the ordinary cars, and a chauffeur, and I played it up. But you see, the secret of my success was that in spite of being a playboy, I never touched anything stronger than orange juice, as you'll see in the book in The Black Eagle.
I remember you told me you didn't drink, you don't smoke.
No. And if you come to my house, you'll see bottles of water line up in the hallway.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I think you showed them to
yeah.
me when I was there.
Yes.
Is that a moral thing or just...
No, it's not moral. It's practical. I mean, I study anatomy and studied medicine, and I know that the water in New York City is the worst water in the world. And
no, Los Angeles water is the worst water in the world.
So?
Yes. I drink a lot of water. I assure you it is.
Yes. And as far as smoking is concerned and alcohol, the reason why I abstained from alcohol was that in order to survive in the early days, as you'll see in my book, The Black Eagle, you have to have your wits because plane was so fragile. You couldn't be drinking and flying. You had to put your plane together. You had to be your own navigator, your own avigator. And men, even during the war, those that drank and fly, of course, they never lived to fly again.
Colonel Hubert Julian is here today, and we're discussing his recently published book. The publisher, by the way, is Stein and Day, and the book is called The Black Eagle, and it's written by John Pierre Nugent. I want to ask you, Colonel, did you ever think about what there might have been in your early background that made you such an extraordinary person? Was it your parents or your upbringing? Or?
Yes, yes. The fact is that you have a white mother and a black father. And your mother's titled, and she said to your son, you're here for a purpose. Look in the mirror. No man is your superior. There's nothing that has been done that you cannot do. Then I used to have visions. As a boy, I used to dream that I was flying. I was an angel. I used to fly from place to place. I've been pursued, and I'll be left bodily.
Now, at that time, no one flew, because you're what, 73?
73, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, when I was a young boy, I was 5 years of age, 6 years of age, when the plane was invented. 1903, the Wright brothers invented the plane. I was born 1897, so I was five.
Well, were your fantasies even before that, or?
No, it was during that period.
That was your first ambition,
to be
a flyer.
To be a flyer, to be something, to get away from the world, to soar. I used to lay and watch the seagulls and said, oh, if I could only fly on our estate on the ocean in Toko. I used to see the seagulls, and there was a time I heard a big fight, and there was a seagull that was badly beaten. It happened to be a black seagull, and I nursed him and called him my pet. And after he got well, he used to fly and come back until he brought a mate. And that became an obsession to me. I wanted to be a doctor, and I wouldn't study. I could do nothing, but emulate what Columbus did. I wanted to be the black Columbus of the air.
Well,
my greatest ambition was when I went to the President of the United States, who I knew personally, the late President Roosevelt, And he said, what can I do for you? I said, I just want you to see to it that black men are given an equal opportunity in the Air Corps and in the Army and Navy. And my greatest thrill in life was when I saw a black man receiving 3 stars in the Air Corps. I'm referring to Lieutenant General Davis. I knew his father very well. We traveled together, and I told him, let your son join the Air Corps. It's the future of tomorrow.
Do you have children?
Well, we have 2 grandsons, one 27 and the other 22.
What do they think about your career?
Well, they think I'm crazy. They said, oh, we'll never do what you did, Dad. Oh, no.
A lot of people thought you were, though, didn't they?
Well, any time you do anything out of the ordinary, you have to be insane.
Yeah.
You have to be insane to go to Italy to assassinate the leader of the Italian government. You have to be insane. Columbus had to be insane to take those fragile ships to cross the Atlantic. Lindbergh had to be insane. All men who do things that are not stereotype, people who look at them, they said, well, he has to be crazy to do those things, and fools usually laugh at their own folly.
What do you think about the black movement now in the United States?
Which black movement?
Well, all right, that's a good question. Any of them. Which do you identify with?
None.
What's your alternative? What?
My alternative is, we have, you talk about, they mentioned something about black power. There is no such thing as power. You see, we have 200 odd million people in the United States, and the Negroes are about 20 million. To have power, you must be able to have institutions, employ. You have to go into your laboratories and discover a cure for cancer. You have to be able to be indispensable. But the black race is not indispensable whether we like it or not. It's factual. We are dependent. We are a dependent race. We do not produce. We consume. I cannot hate you. Why should I hate you? Hate Whitey is some of the fools. If I hate you, who's going to supply me with the medicines? Who's going to supply me with the eyeglasses here that my black brother is wearing, the watch he's wearing, the clothes he's wearing, the food, the medicine? We produce nothing. We consume. We are dispensable. We are not indispensable. And when we get to the stage that we learn to realize that we have to live with each other and have the education, the greatest power that the Negro needs is education. I educated myself. I speak foreign languages. I go all over the world. I have no barriers. I permit no barriers to be erected. There's no barrier that is not surmountable. I surmount them all. I travel all over the world on the Queen Mary, the Queen Elizabeth, all ships, first class, and I meet everybody. I met the greatest financiers, the Fords, the DuPonts. I know them all. And I am treated as an equal because I treat myself accordingly. That's why I always want to be sober. Nobody could say Hubert Union was a drunkard, that he assaulted this young woman. No, no, no. Whatever I do it with the sanity and the knowledge of what has been done. And all I ask my people of the black race to do is educate yourself. Look in the mirror and say that I am the equal. Solomon was a black man. He was one of the greatest men in the world. But he had the intellect. The people came from all. The Queen of Sheba traveled for thousands of miles and said, oh, Solomon, be a man tonight. And he was a man to her. But she came not for that purpose. She came to be imbued with his wisdom. I have people calling me from all over the world, asking me to come to Europe to appear on television, not to sing and dance, but to lecture, to give my experiences of my world travel and my thoughts of world affairs. And that's what I like about the Black Eagle. And that's what I stated in that book, The Black Eagle, to be a man.
Did you ever, at any time, just wish you'd been just an ordinary man?
No. Life wouldn't be worth living.
You wouldn't have been able to stand it?
No, I couldn't.
Why,
no.
Too boring?
Too boring, and the man who lacks an education, lacks the willpower, he's relegated to among the ordinary peasants. There was a newspaper here, I don't know if it's before your time, it was called...
PM?
No. It was a tabloid.
The World?
No,
the Mirror. World.
The Mirror.
Yeah.
And the Mirror carried daily a picture or a sketch of a man who had exceeded the ordinary people, and he was lifted above the crowd. Above the crowd. I want to be above the crowd. I don't want to be Impluvius Mumnius. No. I couldn't live. I'll die tomorrow. If I was just an ordinary Hubert Julian, I would die tomorrow. I couldn't stand it.
What about Marcus Garvey? Did he inspire you at all?
Yes, he did. He was one of the greatest. Yes, he had visions of what is today a free Africa. And the American Negroes had him in prison because they were not interested. You see, it was a malconception. Marcus Garvey didn't want all the Negroes. All the Jews are not going to Palestine, otherwise there'll be no Palestines. You have to have Jews here to support Palestine. Marcus Garvey wanted to have a kingdom in Africa, where those of us who were intellectual enough to go and reside in Africa, but the majority to live here.
Was he bitter about their attitude?
Because very bitter. He died bitter.
Because he was really ahead of his time.
Well, very much so. I'm told I'm 200 years ahead of my time. Unfortunately, if I was 25 years younger, as a matter of fact, if it wasn't for the family ties that I have, I would live in America for 24 hours.
Well, don't you think that the black people who heard him then was more fear than anything else? Don't
yes.
you think they knew he was right? They
yes,
must
yes,
have.
Fear. In other words, as he was resented, so was I. What the devil a foreigner come in here to tell us what to do? A foreign Negro. But that the case is, I wish that I was a Jew. You know why I wish I was a Jew? If I was a Jew, the Jew would have supported me, and Lindbergh would have never been the first to cross the Atlantic. If I was a Jew, I would have the support of Judaism. I believe, if I was a Jew, I would know what the sufferings of Judaism was. The black man doesn't know what it is to suffer. He has more now than he has. He don't know what persecution. He don't know what he knew the lash of slavery, but he doesn't know the torture chamber, Dachau, and all this. The Jews, they're only in the minority. But look what they've accomplished. And the black man allow his religion to enslave him. I'm not an atheist. I believe in God and I say my prayers. But you have all these Negro churches that are collecting hundreds of millions of dollars from the Negro every Sunday and doing nothing with it, just to glorify one man. This is what the book says. And that's what. What about tomorrow?
Well, but the blacks, don't you think today have a much stronger sense of identity? That if there were a young Colonel Julian who emerged, don't you think that they would support him?
Well, I believe the young Negro of today, the revolutionary Negro of today, I like a militant Negro that will fight for his... But the only thing I dislike is, I don't want a group of Negroes to say that this is civil rights and we're going to tear down this institution and tear down this so we could plunder it. That's not civil rights at all. I like a group that will fight for its rights. Stand up for your rights. But you cannot stand up for something that you're not qualified for. I couldn't come here and said, well, I'm a black man, I want to take charge of this radio station. I'm a black man, I want to take charge of this institution, if I haven't the qualification.
Michael, you want to ask Colonel something? We've got a couple more minutes. Come on.
It's very strange. I wanted to go back into something about you were saying about... I think the main point is black people are trying to say that we're at a point now that they know what their capabilities are. You see, and they know that we can make things to be used by ourselves. You see, that's what I'm not clear about. You're saying that the black people are dependent, but I think that a lot of them are saying that there's a certain amount of independence that must be realized. We're only as dependent as we think we are. We can be more independent by ourselves.
All right. So, supposing I answer by saying that, let's say, for example, that the great utilities company like Con Edison... and the New York Telephone Company will say tomorrow, well, now, members of the Negro race, you're 200 million. You're 20 million, we're 200 million. Because of the grade of the man and your stress in black power, as of the 1st of July, you supply your own electricity, your own telephone. Do you know any group of Negroes who could supply their own electricity and telephone for the millions of Negroes? That's the point I'm stressing. I'm not saying that we can't make shoes or we can't make a suit of clothes. But what about chemistry?
You don't think we're shortchanged with all we're putting into the economy and all the power that's behind us? You don't think we're getting our value?
No, we are not. You're not getting it because you're only a consumer. You see, the reason why you're not getting what you're entitled for is because you're a consumer, not a producer. In other words, I'll just give you a very little example. I am a baker, and you're my manager, and we bake 2 million loaves of bread, right? Now, your duty is to take a dozen loaves of bread for your family and my family, right? That's the first thing. The rest you sell to the consumer. The time comes now that we can only make 12 loaves of bread. What are we going to do with the 12 loaves? It's only an analogy. What I'm trying to say is this, that what the black man should do is buy more stock in corporations, entering them to be a part of it. You understand? Now, when the telephone company was selling shares, we didn't buy shares at 10 cents a share today. It's worth hundreds of dollars. Therefore, if you're a shareholder, you have a voice. But if you're only buying what I make, then you'll take what I give you.
But you can see that you do have an unfair advantage. And that you've got, you're so far ahead of a lot of other blacks.
Are you referring to Hubert Julian in person?
Yes, Hubert.
I created that myself.
But you didn't create all of it yourself.
Pardon me, sir. You know how I created it myself? By risking my life to make a name. Now, when I made my parachute jumpers, you read in Black Eagle, if I die, I'll have known nothing about it. I lived, and the world knew about it. I started across the Atlantic. I fell in the ocean. I could have been dead. I went to Finland to fight wars. I served in four wars. I did it for a purpose. I wanted to show the capabilities of the black man, if only given an opportunity. When I've tried to cross the Atlantic, I wanted to show that as you have black birds, you'll have white birds. I wanted to show, to be an inspiration to the black youths, to show them, as I have flown, you could fly. And today we have men in the Air Corps who are superb, black men. We have admirals in the Navy.
I do have another question to ask you. You mentioned black revolutionaries. What is your opinion of the Angela Davis case?
What is my no opinion?
All right.
I think the point that Michael was trying to make, and we're already over time, is that there are a great many people, black and white, you know, who didn't have your basic advantages. Number one, your mother told you you were as good as anybody else. There are a lot of them.
Instill that into me.
Exactly, and there are a great many people, both white and black, who were brought up to believe that they weren't. As a matter of fact, they were told that their spirit was broken.
Yes, unfortunately.
Yes, it is unfortunate. I wish we had more time, Colonel, because we could talk with you for hours. Colonel Hubert Julian has been with us today. Michael Knowles has helped me with the interview, and we've been talking about the new book, was just published by Stein and Day. It's called The Black Eagle, and it's available now, and the author is John Pierre Nugent. Colonel Julian, it was a pleasure again talking
pleasure
with you.
Pleasure was all mine.
Good.
It's nice seeing you again after having visited me at my home before, and it's nothing new. I haven't changed, and I have no desire to change.
Good. We like you the way you are. Thank you very much for the interview, and thank you for listening, and I hope you all have a very nice evening.
Thank you very much.